Shavua Tov. It's good to sort of see you. This year is dedicated Le'ilui Nishmas Rachaleya Bas Rav Chaim Tzvi. We're starting something new, something that's very connected to what we're doing in terms of our reality of living this time of year with Sukkot upon us. The end of Sukkot, Atzeret, is Simchas Torah. So we're going to talk about today, and this will be the first of a series, on what Torah is and why we learn it, and where we fit into it, and how it changes our lives, and what it does for us spiritually, all of these topics. We're going to talk about what Torah actually is, and what the joy of Torah is, and what Simchas Torah is for women. So what's Torah? Torah is the blueprint of the world. What that means is that it's not a response to the world. It's not, well, there are people, and people have jealousies and pettiness and quarrels and hatred, and therefore to say, lo tirtzach, don't murder. No, Hashem wanted people to be able to choose to value His image and to see preciousness and eternity in the face of every person. And in order for us to choose that, He created a world in which murder would be possible so that we could affirm the value of life. So the value of Lo Tirtzach existed before a world in which it could be practiced existed. So in that sense, this is what's meant by the famous Mamar, Histakle Boraita Uvara Alma. He looked into the Torah and he built a world to fit that pattern. So let's talk about what a pattern is for. If you were to buy a dress in the old days, the first step along the way is going to be measured and have a pattern constructed, and then there's the dress. So the dress is there for you. You existed before the dress. We just said the Torah pre-existed the world. So which is it? Is the Torah for us, meaning we're there, and the Torah is tailor-made to who we are? Or is the Torah in existence and we're tailor-made, so to speak, to fit it? What's the truth? So at this point, we have to differentiate between the world as a whole and the souls of Israel. The souls of Israel pre-existed the Torah. I want you to realize the implication of this. The souls of Israel pre-existed the Torah. So it means Hashem made the Torah, which is the world's blueprint, to act as a bond between us and Him. What's the implication of that in our own lives? So let's look at these fairly complex ideas and divide them into two. The first is that the Torah is the blueprint of the world. The second is that we pre-existed the Torah. Our pre-existence of the Torah means that the souls of Israel, our collective soul, the part that makes us one, is as close to the essence of Hashem as anything could possibly be. So what that takes you to, because I know who we are, you know who we are, our souls are so precious and so eternal and so transcendent, that's me who had like 2 minutes worth of like inner conflict about what kind of topic to put on the diet yogurt. What's so spiritual about that? So the idea is that the soul, so to speak, was sent into exile. This world is a place of exile. And because of this, it doesn't have a permanent feel to it. We're always restless. The goal of this world is to redeem the soul from its exile. The world was created as a backdrop to the soul's need for free choice. The Torah is the key. So the Torah had to exist before the world, since the world is meant to be a backdrop to making choices. The possibility of choice had to be there before. Torah is the book of choices, the book of freedom, the book of possibility. So Torah had to be there before the rest of the world was there. So with this in mind, let's think about us and let's think about Torah. We're very complex. Have you noticed how complex we are? You know, so a person will say, it wasn't the real me who spoke Lashon Hara. The real me affirms life, believes in people. So then, who was it who spoke Lashon Hara? Charlie speaking through my mouth? Michael? What do you mean it wasn't me? So who was it? So the idea is that the animal soul is also the self. It's not somebody else, it's the self. And the animal self frequently overtakes the spiritual self. Our hope is, of course, that the spiritual self prevail, but they're continually at each other. So the only way that we could strengthen the spiritual self enough to prevail is through the Torah. There's a chazal that tells us, Barati Sefet, Barati Yetzahara, Barati Torah Tavlin Lo. Hashem says, I created the Yetzahara, which is an interesting idea. What do you mean he created the Yetzahara? Hashem wants good or he wants evil? But let's put the idea there just for a moment and go back to it. V'barati Torah tavlin lo, and I created the Torah as its remedy. So what that means is that the only remedy for the Yetzahara is Torah. So the same way a person could say, there's an illness called scurvy. Scurvy is an illness that people began to observe after the age of exploration, when sailors would go out on these monumentous trips from Europe to Africa or whatever. And of course, they had no refrigeration in those years. We're talking about the 1500s, 1600s. So people would take whatever didn't spoil, dried meat, dried fruits, rice, okay, anything that was dry. An illness that became pretty prevalent among the sailors was scurvy. What was that? It was an illness that was caused by lack of vitamin C. How was scurvy cured? You no longer hear of scurvy. All they had to do was eat a lemon once in a while, an orange once in a while, or even a vitamin C pill, and then there's no more scurvy. So if somebody were to say, here's scurvy, it's on the boat, what should we do? The only answer is vitamin C, either in natural form or synthetic form. But if you're going to say, let's try diet and exercise. Now those are wonderful things, but they're not going to do a thing for scurvy. Let's say you would say, eat whole wheat. Very good, but it has nothing to do with scurvy. So similarly, we have the problem of evil. There are a lot of ways in which people try to drive evil out of their lives. Some of them are noble. Some of them are significant, but you know what? They don't work. Only Torah works. And I want to back this up, at least for a moment, with something I observed. The only kirev tool that really, really works is learning. I've seen that you could get people enthused about doing and believing, but unless we get them to learn, it doesn't always stick. So the Torah is the resolution, the Torah is the cure, and it's the only cure. With that in mind, let's talk about what the Yetzirah is. What's the Yetzirah? The Yetzirah is the force that makes us think that evil is creative. Lietzer, in a verb form, is to manufacture, it's to make something out of existing components. Yetzirah is to take the world with all of its existing components and to make evil out of it. Is this possible? Of course it's possible. So Yetzahara, we all have Yetzahara. We all confuse good with evil now and again. What causes that? What causes that is that we see the physical world is more vivid than the spiritual world, and we let it blind us. So the only thing that cures us of this blindness is the Torah. Nothing else works. Barasi Yetzahara, Barasi Torah Tavlin Lo. So similarly, it says in Navi, it says, and they've left me. And the Navi says, I wish that they would leave me but keep my Torah rather than vice versa. Why? Because the light of the Torah will draw them back to goodness. So Torah is unique in this regard. So Sun Simchas Torah will be upon us. So a question that comes up every single year is, who should a woman be on Simchas Torah? So why is that even a question? Obviously, the question is a question because the ones who are essentially celebrating are the men. They're the ones who are in shul dancing with the Torah. The women are the ones who are watching the men in shul dance with the Torah. So there are different ways of approaching this. One way of approach, which is in the United States is fairly popular, in Israel less so, is changing the rules of the game so that the women could also be in the women's shul, dance with the Torah there. That's one way of doing it. So one way of dealing with the problem isn't solving it, but what? It's acting as though there is no problem. Oh, women have Simchas Torah, the same as men, see? Okay. So there are a few problems with this solution. The greatest problem is that there's no tradition to it. So it says about us, if we're not prophets, we're the children of prophets. Our intuitive sense of how things should be is coming from a higher place than most of us realize. So there is a counter-argument to this, as many of you know. The counter-argument, so there's no place for innovation. What about Beis Yaakov? What about Hillel making the calendar? So the answer is that there's a big difference between rewriting the script and strengthening the script. Strengthening the script means taking what's there and making it stronger, even more what it is, not less. So if you look at Beis Yaakov, or if you look at Hillel's institutions, what you see is the goal of Beis Yaakov, if Sarah Schneer could have pressed her finger to the button, the one that says go, and produce a girl, she would be a very feminine person. She would be a mother, she would be a wife, that would come first. Okay, she wouldn't think that the Gemara is her best friend. She would have no identity crisis. So the solution that people have today, which is seeing men and women as almost identical, it doesn't deal with the real question. The question is, why in our tradition are men dancing with the Torah and women are watching men dance with the Torah? That's clearly what the tradition is, and the tradition is coming from our collective consciousness. So another argument would be Nishtanu Hativiyam, the people's natures changed, meaning that in earlier times when the traditions developed, women had less of a connection to Torah than they do now. And because of that, in those days, what would be proper for women would be to experience spirituality through their men. So thus, they should watch the dancing. And today we've improved. We're much more spiritual today than we were, let's say, in Rashi's time. And therefore, new traditions are in the process of developing, ones in which women are very much part of Simchas Torah, directly participant, dancing with the Torah in the main area, with the men fenced off when the women are dancing. Okay. So the answer from a Jewish perspective is, again, if we're not Nevi'im, we're the children of Nevi'im. The argument of Nishtanu Hativiyam is an argument with some merit to it. Certainly in Gemara we have many instances where a psak could change because of Nishtanu Hativiyam. Certainly our physical constitutions are very different than they were when we were living in Israel. Certainly longevity and health are all being eroded by the atmosphere's pollution. So there are things that change. It's not like nothing changed. The question is whether the inside changes. Okay, does the inside change? Will men be more like women? Will women be more like men in the future? And have their natures changed already? So on the surface of things, you could find some support. In other words, many generalizations that were made in Rambam or by the sages about women don't necessarily ring true today, but if we were standing where they were standing, it could be they would ring true then. But the question is what changed women, or is what changed women's approach to themselves? So I tend to doubt the argument of Nishtanu Hativiyam. It still seems to me that women are women, that women think differently than men, speak differently than men, in terms of physical demonstration. Women are not identical to men. Women's brains are not identical to men's brains. Even in the feminist heyday of the 80s, nobody was ever able to devise a test in which men did as well as with language as women, and women did as well at spatial values as men. Didn't happen. And it wasn't for lack of effort or lack of money. So what am I saying with all this? I'm saying that we still have a question. And that the answer to the question isn't nishtano hativiyam, and therefore we should somehow can the women's role and adapt the men's role, so that there are two kinds of men, women who are men and men who are men. I don't believe that that's what nishtano hativiyam is about, if there's such a thing at all. Okay, so where's the place? So there are several places where you could put your heart as well as your mind and eyes on Simchas Torah. The first is that there's a rule, which is that a parent isn't jealous of their child. So you say, but they're not my children. But what do I mean by this? And the laws concerning the fate of somebody who kills a thief who will enter their home to steal. You know, you get up in the middle of the night, you hear footsteps, you go down to take a look. There they are, two robbers putting everything in their bags. And you notice they saw you. And the next step is going to be that they kill you. So you take out your knife and kill them until you're safe. In other words, if you could just wound them and you'll be safe, that would be your obligation. But you couldn't even have to kill them. So what am I telling you this for? The reason for this halacha is that our assumption is that if somebody comes to rob, he's prepared to kill. Everybody knows that people will fight for their property. Everybody knows that people will try to get their property back. So if a person tries to stop a robbery at 6 o'clock, he knows when the people got up. He knows they got up at 5 or whatever, because that's the way it is. So nishtano hativiyam, it's very hard to maintain that. We are who we are. Men are not women, women are not men, and it doesn't seem to be part of the great plan for everyone to, so to speak, convert it to the male model. In fact, it's easier to maintain that since Malchut, which is the ultimate feminine model, that will be the model that prevails as such, as Malchut, not becoming Chachma or any of the other more male attributes. What's Malchut, what's Chachma? Malchut is the ability to receive, let's say from Hashem, and to build on what he gives. For a subject to receive from what the king provides, and to build a kingdom out of it. There's so much in Chazal about how the future will be a time in which Hashem will rule, and the word rule is used again and again. And since we're in this pattern, it seems that Malchut is the preeminent Midah. Chachma is the means through which the divine flow of wisdom comes down to us through Torah and through other means. So what I'm saying through all of this is that for man to be part of the divine plan, he has to bring down the Torah from above to below. So obviously not everybody is a huge Talmud Chacham, but somewhere in his life, and if you look at Shulchan Aruch Harav, if you look at the Rambam, the loopholes are narrow. If he's sick or if he's well, if he's rich or if he's poor, he still has to learn. Why? Because he has to provide. The same way a man has to provide materially, he has to provide spiritually. He has to. That's his only weapon against the Yetzirah. A woman has to take it in and build with it. She has to take it in and she has to build. So now let's look at Simchas Torah. So the men who have a direct relationship to the Torah, how direct? So direct that it's their entire identity as spiritual people. They're rejoicing with the Torah, with their source of sustenance. The women who have to hear the Torah and receive it through the men's providing them with Torah should feel true joy in seeing the man dance with the Torah. What's this like? The Gemara narrates how it was like in Simchas Beis HaShoeva in ancient times. In ancient times, only to use the words of the text, Chasidim va'anshei maisa, pious people, men of great deeds, danced on the floor of the Azara with other people watching. So I want you to be there, Tzivav Gamliel, juggling 8 torches. It was through spiritual power. He wasn't an acrobat. He didn't practice. This is that he was in control of fire and gravity through the Torah that was him. Could you picture saying, hey, wait a minute, what's he doing there? What about me, me, me? Okay, you wouldn't say that. And I want to tell you why. Because the soul of Israel is one soul. So there's a part of everyone, men and women, who when they look at Rav Gamliel, you know who they see? They see the aspect of Rav Gamliel that exists in them. So now let's bring this back to contemporary reality. When a woman is watching Dancing on Simchas Torah, ideally, what's being touched within her is the part of her that wants to dance and receive Torah. So she and the man who's actually dancing are in that sense one at that moment. Okay, now let's talk about reality. The reality is that women do feel this way. When you go to where the simcha is real, where there's no showing off, where there's no self-consciousness, that's what you see. A problem that some people have with this is a prophetic statement, which is in the future, there'll be a circle of tzaddikim, dancing, so to speak, around Hashem. So what that means is that everyone, men and women, will receive directly from Hashem, not through each other. And this is true, obviously. It's a prophecy. What does that mean? What it means is that each person, in their own way, will become God-aware. It doesn't mean that anybody is God-aware the same way anybody else is. In a circle, everybody sees from their own angle. There's no reason why this prophecy has to mean that men and women will ever walk the same road. Okay, now, having said all that, it seems to be, though, however, certainly within the last 100 years, that Hashem is bringing women to a place of more direct access to Torah than ever before. So what's that all about? If women are women and men are men and never the twain shall meet, what's happening here? So what's happening here is that it seems that Hashem on his side is bringing about a process in which our access to him through Torah will be more direct, not necessarily because we've changed, but because he's taking us to a different place. Historically, women's access to Torah was mostly experiential and to a large degree osmosis. Today, to a large degree, it's intellectual. Women actually learn. And even the most conservative, and by conservative I mean traditionalist, not part of conservative Judaism, even the most conservative circles, Yerushalayim, the Hasidic world, Satmar, they have schools for girls. And in the girls' schools, they actually learn something. They don't try to only receive, they also try to integrate. History is from Hashem. As it comes forth, Hashem seems to be taking women to a different place. But interestingly, and I could say this with some credibility, what women seem to be drawn to is the aspect of Torah that relates dafka to the more feminine side of them. And what side is that? So as Maharal and many others say, Emunah is feminine, Emes is masculine, as traits. Emes means seeing things as they are by knowing Torah well enough to know this is Mutter and that's Usser and this is Pusel and this is Kosher and he's Chayav and he's Zakai. Okay, but the movement is from above to below. What's Emunah? It's looking at the world and seeing Hashem there and uplifting the world. So Emunah moves from down to up. Emes moves from up to down. In the women's schools, the classes that go over the best, the ones that draw the most interest, are the ones that are aimed at the inner self, at Pnimiut. the ones that are technical, the ones that talk about the entire mosaic of being, of Patur and Chayav, etc., and the reasoning behind it, are much less attractive. So what this seems to be telling me is that women certainly have a chelik in Torah that's distinctly their own, and not to be confused with the chelik of men. So again, and where does that put women on Simchas Torah? So it puts them in a place in which they have profound appreciation for the Torah, love the Torah, but don't necessarily want to approach the Torah using the same style or consciousness of men. So that's Simchas Torah. Let's move now and talk about what the Torah actually is. What do I mean when I say that? I'm going to begin, and I hope finish, I'm not sure how this will work time-wise, but I'll begin and hopefully finish a survey of what actually is meant when we say Torah. So Hashem created Torah, the blueprint for the world he was doing. Let's call that Torah, Torah Keduma, primordial Torah. When Adam was created, he was created knowing. So it means he knew primordial Torah. So it was on that basis that he was able to give names to everything. So what's a name for? A name is something that you only need for the sake of the other. So I'm thinking about myself. I don't say, oh, Tzipporah, how are you doing today? I'm thinking, how do I feel? I don't say, Tzipporah, you're thirsty. I say, I'm thirsty. A name is to give other people the ability to relate to me and call me. So if Adam knew how to name things, he knew a great deal about what he was naming. He could say, this is what this is in essence. So all of the names in Hebrew that Adam gave reflect this absolute awareness of the blueprint. This is what this is, and this is what it's for. So I always come back to the example with dogs. A dog is kelev, which means kalev, like the heart. That's what it is in essence. It's faithful. Okay, in some regard, it's like the human heart. So because of this, our relationship to dogs is assumptioned on it, because the dog follows the blueprint. Okay, a dog is also the symbol of chutzpah. Why? Because it has little personality of its own. It's like the human heart. So it pretends to be a human by becoming your best friend or your housemate. But still a dog. Okay, Adam knew this. He passed it on. Who received it? So Shet, it says concerning Shet, that he's the one of Adam's three sons who's described as being in the demut of Hashem just as Adam was. So the fact that he was the whole one means of all of the other two, he's the only one who really could have gotten the truth. Cain and Hevel both distorted the truth by their own personalities, which tells you that the most fragile part of Torah is this, that it's interpreted by people with personalities. Cain was very earthly, very this world oriented. He saw everything one way, Hevel saw things another way. Shet saw the whole picture. What we'll notice is between Shet and Noach, there are many generations. Of these generations, there were some who were the actual torchbearer for Torah in their times and passed it on. So you have, for instance, Chanoch, whose name literally means inception or education, who was a great person. He was Miyachid Yechudim as he made sandals. That means he saw God's unity with the world as he made sandals. And what would he do? He would have in mind that the sandals be serviceable and comfortable and beautiful. And through making those kind of sandals, he's being imitative of Hashem. So he knew Torah. He knew about uplifting the world. He knew about Dveikus. He knew. But what Torah was that? It was Torah Keduma. It was the Torah that was given at the world's beginning. That Torah was lost. So by the time we get to Avraham, there's no one from him to learn. No one. Okay, Noach is gone. The sages who pre-existed him, Chanoch, Metushelach, who was a hermit who learned in Dvekas, in absolute isolation, they're all gone. So a very reasonable question is, how could the world continue? And the answer is, he'll give us the Torah. So it means he won't just make it a subconscious implant, he'll actually give it to us. So this, which is of course huge. So the Gemara tells us that the angels protested this. They said, how are you going to give this Torah to a human being? Is there a problem? Yeah, people don't always fit Torah into their lives so easily. So the answer Hashem gave is that it's totally irrelevant to you. It says don't murder, you murder. It says don't steal, you steal. You're perfect. So the idea there is our perfection is our ability and desire to actually encounter the Yetzirah. That's Torah Kaduma. It's how to do it. So Adam knew Torah Kaduma, passed it on to Shet. So when Shet was alive, and thereafter, everyone knew the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. They became part of what's called the collective consciousness of the world. What exactly is included in the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach? So you have no idol worship, meaning Hashem expects, if you're bright enough, to even once in your life walk through a forest, or stand on the roof and see the sunset, or get up early enough to see the sunrise. Even if that's all it is, there's an expectation. What's the expectation? The expectation is that you're alive, that you'll respond. Okay, so in the course of time, the Torah had to be given to a whole nation, people who could make collectively a meaningful response. You could say, well, why can't individuals make a meaningful response? What would have been so bad if God would have given the Torah to Avraham? So the answer, as we said already, is that the collective soul of Israel is one soul. Even anyone's being missing makes it impossible for the Torah to be given. So at the time the Torah was given, there were over 600,000 Jews receiving, which is not all the Jews they were. So this is a statement. The statement is everybody knows Torah Keduma because we were all there to receive it at Har Sinai. Even those of us who later chose not to internalize it or who weren't able to internalize it, they didn't have the opportunity, Torah is still part of them. So for that reason, I'll tell you another true story. There was out of town, as we say in America, we snobbish people. Out of town, there was a certain rabbi. And this rabbi was trying nobly, really nobly, to teach. As, you know, that's his position. And he had to get across to his students that there's such a thing as choosing to learn, as nasa v'nishma. And if you want the Torah to be yours, you have to choose it. How did he do it? The way he did it was by asking them what they really want in life. And it'll come down to connection. So the lowest level of Torah Kedumah is out of self-interest. You want to be connected, you want to be powerful, out of self-interest, do it. So that's Torah Kedumah, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, which people knew because of its imprint. As time went on, Hashem began to begin to give the Torah little by little. It wasn't just all one big revelation at Vav Sinai. So the first time people were addressed with Torah was when Yaakov, after his encounter with Esav's angel, was told not to eat Git HaNashen, not to eat the sciatic nerve. So this means that we're going beyond what we had already. So what is this like? Remember in my allegory with outpouring water that we spoke about various times in the Shiurim. If you don't want to be drowned by the water, there has to be a filter. So it comes down drop by drop. So the first filter for divine wisdom was the souls of Israel. Then the world. Then the Sheva Mitzvot. Next, After the Sheva Mitzvahs, you have individual mitzvot that were given to different people in view of their seeking. Then you have the Torah given. So now I'm moving from Torah Keduma, the Torah that's the blueprint of the world that people always knew about through observing the world's existence and letting their minds move. We're moving from there to a given Torah. What's this for, and how does either one of these fit the mamar we learned at the beginning, Barati Yetzahara Barati Torah Tavlin Lo? So let's talk first about being a Noahide, and then we'll talk about being a Jew. I know people who are Noahides, not well, but I do know them. I was once at one of their conventions. They're sincere people, non-Jews, who want to keep the seven mitzvahs of Bnei Noach. They ask serious rabbis for psak and try to help Jews. This is what they see their shlichus as being. And this is okay. But what's our shlichus? Who are we meant to be? As women, as individuals? So we're meant to be, as recipients of the Torah, are people who take the Torah and use it. So now let's talk about the concept of learning Torah lishma. Learning Torah for its own sake. If you're going to see the blueprint, does it have to be that you put your ego down so low? So it's not simple, because all Jews could learn some Torah. But the bottom line is, yes, you do have to learn Torah from a place of truth. Okay, so we said Nasev and Ishma. We'll do it and we'll understand it. That's a place of truth. Truth is the whole story, as we said. Our being able to say after a whole day in high shoes, Hashem, wherever you want me to be, that's where I want to be. So when the Jews said Nasev and Ishma, it was a response to having already integrated the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. Some specific mitzvot, such as Brit Milah and Gid Hanasha, that were given to the Avos. But there was one more step. One more very significant step was when they were on their way to the Sinai Desert to receive the Torah. Okay, something happens. They had to stop in a place called Mara. Why did they stop? Because they were thirsty. So thirsty that they were saying crazy things, let's go back to Egypt, at least they gave us drink. Okay, so what happened next? Hashem, since he understood where they weren't that strong or developed as they were at the end, he told Moshe to throw logs into the water, and that then there'll be water, and that's what he did. Strange narrative. It's in the Torah itself. The idea being Hashem allowed Moshe to put great force into the place. And it says that that's where they were taught. What were they taught? So there's some degree of machloket, not very heavy. So the first possibility is these three things. They were taught honoring parents. They were taught Parah Aduma. And they were taught Shabbos. Others will say, rather than honoring parents, they were taught justice. They were taught fairness and everything that goes with that, and they were taught ritual, Shabbos, etc. Why those things? So the idea is that each one of the things that they were taught at Mara represents a whole category of Torah, of the blueprint. So the first on this list was to, yes, worship Hashem and to not worship idols. Now, this is the kind of thing, right, not worship idols, done! I have no desire for that. But this includes all sorts of things. It includes anything that once was idolatrous, could be used for idolatrous purposes, etc. So why did we have to know that? Why was that so basic? The reason why it was so basic is that that actually is the essence of one whole part of Torah called the Mishpatim, the laws of justice. So we had to say yes to that, knowingly. So what's the fuel that makes a law of justice possible? So the answer is, our sphirot know what it is, and it responds. So that means when the Torah says lo tirtzach, which is a very, very reasonable law, don't murder, our souls respond to it. So we're able to say don't murder means don't murder. It doesn't just mean don't murder somebody who you don't like, or don't murder anybody else who feel even remotely threatened by them. It means don't murder, period. See life as sacred. So those are the mishpatim. Okay, where does it take a person? If a person really, really integrates this as a value, that whatever Hashem forbids is forbidden for our benefit, and we would gain nothing by having it, which isn't the same as saying retroactively it didn't taste good. I mean now. So when you take that reality, that you really know what life's about, everything changes. A friend of mine who became a Baal Tshuva rather late in her life decided to allow somebody to do a kidney transplant using her kidney. In fact, as we're recording this class, this is her second day in hospital. So the Mishpat says is there to keep us straight. This is just and that isn't just. This is right, this isn't right. It's very important. Important for what? For seeing reality. Now let's look at Eidot. Eidot are meant to give witness or bear testimony to something. In our case, to what? So again, look at the world. The Torah is its blueprint. There's day and night, black and white, point and counterpoint. The function of the Eidot is to give us a place of balance. The holidays are very much times in which there's very little halacha, in which most people will not work even if there are loopholes, because on a gut level we know this. And in fact, the word moed means a time of meeting. We know that there are times of meeting with Hashem. We know He hasn't given up on us. The third component is called chukim, which means laws that are engraved into the nature of reality, whether we know it or whether we don't. So I'll give you an illustration of this. I don't keep kosher. The fact that kosher is a chuk, there's no, it's engraved into nature. Eat this, don't eat that. It's not dependent on my reasoning or my emotional power. Do I always know what I'm doing? Absolutely not. So what does a chuk do for you? It gives you, even without truly knowing the meaning of the chuk, the ability to skip around your chachma, like one to over the fence, and go straight to the self annihilation of the angels when they say Kadosh, Kadosh. So ideally, this is what the mitzvot are supposed to take us through. They're supposed to move our minds, the mishpatim, our bodies, the chukim, and finally our emotions through the mishpatim. Finally, then, do we move to the Sinai area, and then giving of the Torah begins in earnest. How is it technically given? So the scroll had to be opened in such a way in which Bereishis and Le'inei Kol Yisrael could be found pretty easily. And its reality, the reality of our being the people of the book, gelled. Okay, so this came through our saying Nasa V'Nishma. So learning Torah and Mara wasn't enough. We had to say what's going on inside as we learn Torah. So it has to be an inner environment of Nasa V'Nishma. What is that? Okay, I'll tell you what it sounds like. I had a student once at Neve, I may have told you this story. Very interesting girl. Her parents were Holocaust survivors. She was older. And they suffered so much that they didn't want to be the Jews anymore. What do I mean by this? They didn't want to be a hated minority. They didn't want to be persecuted. They had no problem with Judaism, no problem with Torah, but they had a problem with being members of the persecuted Jewish people. So when they got to America, they moved to Wyoming. They had a farm. And to them, this was paradise. No threatening people, no neighbors, absolute peace and quiet. My friend, their daughter, hated the farm. It was boring beyond anything. It was like a living death to her. Now, her parents never hid the fact that they were Jewish because, again, their issue wasn't Judaism. But she didn't know any Jewish people, didn't go to a Jewish school. So when she finished high school, She insists on going to college in Los Angeles, where there are lots of people, a lot going on, and she did. Okay, she got married to a Jewish guy, surprisingly, and a terrible tragedy happened, and he was killed in an accident. So to make a long story short, that's what brought her to finding an Orthodox rabbi. She was in Los Angeles alone. She had to arrange the funeral. She looked for rabbis in the telephone book. The first one she got who answered was Rabbi Chapnick of the Jewish Learning Exchange. Of course, befriended her and cared for her, got her to Israel. She's learning in Neve. We're giving a class on Tznius. I spoke about what Tznius is about. She says, I have a question. Now, I didn't know anything about her history, realize. So she said if a person was married at one time, but is not married in the present, they're widowed or divorced, do they have to cover their hair like a married woman does? And I was afraid to tell her the truth, because I don't know where she is in Judaic practice. That's pretty high up the ladder. But I couldn't lie either. So I said, there's more than one view on this topic, and perhaps when we have the basics down, we'll discuss it. So she said, can I talk to you after class? So I said, yes. So after class, she says, like, really? Do you have to or don't you have to? So I told her what the various views were, to at least some degree. But I told her, you don't have to do this now. It's not number one on the list. There's Shabbos, there's Kashrus. This is too hard to even think about, because she had told me she had been married. So she said, I have a question. So I said, what? Is there a hat store in Har Nof? So I said, sure, there's Racheli's near the supermarket. The next day she came in wearing a hat, and the rest, as they say, is history. She was completely observant of this and ultimately of everything. But what's that? What she was really saying is, if God said it, I'll do it. That's Nasa V'Nishma. Not, does it fit me? That would be the view of it that's saying the world exists and the Torah fits the world that we spoke about at the beginning. People are murderers, murder is bad, so it says Lo Tirtzach, don't murder. That's not what the Torah is. The world was made for the Torah. She saw herself in that frame. She didn't want to say, does this mitzvah feel comfortable to me? No. Could I become a person who does this mitzvah? And the answer to her was yes. That's Nasa V'Nishma. So now what do we know? Let's sum things up. We know about Torah Kedumah. We know it was passed from Adam to his descendants through Shet, later Chanoch, Metushelach, Noach, Avraham via the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, where they're studying what all of the Torah Kedumah, what was actually known. We spoke about Hashem opening the gates somewhat and teaching individual mitzvah to specific ones of the Avot. Mila to Avraham, Gita Nashe, not eating the sciatic nerve, to Yaakov. And then we said, more happened. The Jews got to Mara, where they learned Chukim, Edot, and Mishpatim. Para Aduma, the ultimate chok, the least accessible intellectually of all of the mitzvot, the one that involves uplifting physical realities through the sacrifice involving a red heifer in ways that we've never grasped and are not likely to grasp. He taught Eidot, Shabbos, things that give us an emotional grip on Torah through celebrating Hashem's relationship to us. He taught Mishpatim, the mitzvot that give us the ability to submit our minds and our thoughts towards Hashem's plans. He taught us all of this and got us to a place where we could say Nasa V'Nishma, that we will follow the pattern of the Torah, we'll see it as our blueprint, and with that in mind we realize then that it's the only weapon against the Yetzer Hara. Why? Because the job of the Yetzer Hara is what? Is to make us feel autonomous and distant from Hashem and his pattern. The only way to return to the pattern is by, hold on to your seats, returning to the pattern. We have to really go back to the pattern with which Hashem created the world. So the only weapon we have is the Torah. Next time what we're going to talk about is not only where we fit into the Torah as women, now that we know what it is, how we fit ourselves into the blueprint that Hashem set forth, but what the Torah actually is, what's written Torah, what's oral Torah, the mechanics of it, and then we'll go further. And in the meantime, have a good week.